Hello, friends of Soul Kitchen. Thank you for listening to my podcast. My name is Jasper Mutsaerts. I'm an entrepreneur, adventurer, coach, and wisdom seeker. With Soul Kitchen, I interview people that inspire me. From TED speakers to social entrepreneurs, from activists to artists, from dreamers to seekers, from business people to spiritual teachers. With Soul Kitchen, I empower people to live their quest. Each episode contains a recipe for life. What is your quest?
Welcome, friends, to episode 69 on the Soul Kitchen podcast.
69. Today we're going...
It's 69 already. Crazy, right?
That's
crazy. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I'm really on a roll. Sometimes people wonder how I get so productive, but I'm enjoying it. And then I have a talented young man, Andrew, on my side who helps me from South Africa. So episode 69, or maybe you think that's funny for another reason. But anyway, we're going into that.
But also just because it's a love, you know, kind of.
It's a love thing, right? Yeah. So episode 69 is about dating, attachment styles, love, and relationships. And today I'm meeting with Flora Ong from the United States, and I met her last year because last year I started organizing retreats, and we uploaded the retreats on a booking platform called bookretreats.com, and Flora was the first one that came through that booking platform. And during the retreat I got to know her, and I found out that many people in the retreat are actually interested in the topic of dating and attachment styles. So I asked Flora to do a workshop during the retreat. People really liked it. And then we stayed in touch. And at some point, Flora, I was looking for a business coach. And I think at some point we started talking. And then she proposed that I could become her business coach. And in exchange for that, I could participate in her program, the program of Redo Love. So I've already done the 8-week coaching program, which was definitely very helpful. Some insights, some limiting beliefs that have been reframed, and some new perspectives. And today we're going to dive into the topic of dating and attachment styles. And why is this topic interesting for me? I think a few reasons. So I've definitely experienced my fair share of challenges in the dating space, from being anxious or from being avoidant or fantasizing too much or thinking about it too much. All sorts of varieties I have encountered. At the same time, dating is also something that is fun and meaningful to me. I feel I've met a lot of amazing people through it. So there's definitely also positives to it. And then obviously, the attachment styles are also closely connected to childhood experiences. Since I lost my mom at a young age, I also started discovering a bit about things that happened in my childhood in relationship to dating. And then also, as a general point of view, I think human psychology and love is just an interesting topic. And I also find it fascinating why some people fall in love when they're 18 and they always stay together. And then some people have maybe more adventurous dating lives like me. So there's a variety of reasons why I think this is going to be an interesting podcast. And then Flora, next to being, let's say, active in the dating space, she's also, you could say, successful on social media, Instagram and TikTok. So I'm also curious how she's doing that. Well, Flora, it's so good to meet you today. Talking about attachment styles, maybe we should start with the question, what is your attachment style?
Mine. So I like to think I'm more secure these days, but my primary attachment style is anxious. And if anybody knows much about attachment styles, they understand why I ended up doing this work, because the anxiety got the better of me and I had to figure out how to stop it, you know.
So you had to figure out how to stop your anxiety?
Yeah.
And was there like a wake-up call, or had it been a gradual process that you realized you needed to stop it?
Well, it was, I think like a lot of people, I struggled. I got divorced. Okay. I got married very young, first of all. So, and then I got divorced. And when I got divorced, I was having, you know, a lot of fun dating initially, but was also very nervous and got attached very easily. And I felt like I was like 38 at the time, give or take. And I felt like I was 16 all over again, like falling in love for the very first time over and over and over again, you know, with random people that didn't deserve my attention or my energy or any of it. And the faces changed, but the feelings stayed the same. And it was this, you know, feeling of lack, feeling of anxiety, feeling of, you know, that I'm unlovable, that, you know, I'll never find someone, that, you know, what am I doing wrong? Why is this always happening to me? You know, like all of that kind of conversation that was going on in my head. And there was nothing at the time, like there was nothing, it was just in my head. I started to feel like crazy. You know, I started to feel like really something was wrong with me until I read the book Attached by Amir Levine. And within like the first, I think like the first paragraph says something like, you know, also I want to say really important in this world of self-development, right? There's a lot of messaging out there that's like, love yourself and you should be independent and you should be okay by yourself. And you know, it's all about loving yourself. And it's all about you being able to live on your own and do on your own. And, you know, all this like stuff about being on your own. And I remember having this conversation with some guy that was avoidant and that I was trying to date or interested in. And, you know, and he told me he broke up with somebody because she was, she wanted somebody to save her. And out loud, I said something like, oh, that's awful. You know, like people shouldn't be like that, or, you know, that's too much pressure, whatever I said. But inside I was thinking like, but that's what I want, you know, like really what I'm looking for, you know, and I knew it inside, but I was even trying to lie to myself to say that like, oh, I'm independent. I'm fine on my own. I don't need anyone. And I think the first paragraph in the book says something like, you know, the most natural thing in the world is to want love, is to want partnership, is to, it's like part of being a human being, you know? And it lifted this you know, I don't know, this thing from me, and this took so much off my shoulders. And then I read into the anxious part and I was like, oh my God, like this is me word for word, you know? And yeah, and that started me off on my journey.
Wow, that's interesting how you kind of realized that was you. And then after reading the book, what steps did you take, or what changes did you make?
Well, you know, as soon as I like read the book, because at the time I was a matchmaker, and I was already trying to write a book on dating, because in a sense it was like me writing, trying to figure out and trying to have some sort of control over my dating life and helping other people to gain control over their dating life, which is very anxious behavior, right? Like you want to try and control the outcome, which, you know, now I realize there's no controlling the outcome. You just kind of have to let it go. But and so then I read the book and it really just set me off on this path of learning more about attachment styles. And then that led me to understanding the subconscious and how our personalities are formed and how our behaviors and coping mechanisms are formed. And so for me, this is attachment styles gave me the the jumping off point, but it's so much more about our subconscious and how we pick up behaviors and learn to be who we are.
And before we dive into the different attachment styles, where does the attachment theory come from? Like, who invented it?
Bowlby, John Bowlby came, recognized that there was an attachment between the caregiver and the child. You know, they develop like a strong attachment, and a lot of their comfort and personality is based on that relationship. Then Mary Ainsworth did something called, quite a few years later, I think it was in the 70s, she did the strange situation test, which put 1.5-year-olds in a room with their mom, and then their mom would leave the room for a little bit. And there was a stranger in the room that was, there to take care of the kids, and they would watch the kids on video. And depending on how the child reacted when mom came back, they were able to distinguish 4 very specific attachment styles from how the kids were behaving when the mom came back.
And can you elaborate on the different styles when the mom came back?
So there was the kid, the secure kid. Mom would drop the kid, come in the room with the kid, say, okay, mom's going to go right now. Mom would leave the room. The kid might cry a little bit, would see a stranger in the room, and then get comfortable and go play with the toys. Mom would come back. The kid would run up to mom, be really happy to see mom, and then, just go play or, go with mom, whatever the case was. So that was a secure kid, right? Like, it's normal to cry a little bit when mom's leaving, but totally fine, once you realize that there's another person. And then when mom comes back, you're happy to see her. Okay. The anxious child would, mom would leave the room. They would cry. They had a very hard time getting comfortable. They may or may not get comfortable in the room with the stranger. The stranger would have to like coax them. But when mom came back in the room, moreover, the child would go running to mom, yelling and screaming and crying and even hitting mom sometimes. Right now I have on my stories, if anybody's on Instagram, I won't be there, but I have this funny video that like, it's a perfect depiction of this whole thing. Nevertheless, so the anxious kid had these behaviors of being mad at mom for leaving, punishing mom for leaving, and having a very hard time self-regulating, right? Mm-hmm. Then you have the avoidant kid that mom would drop them in the room. The kid would just go straight to the toys. Mom would leave the room. Kid wouldn't even look up to see mom leave, didn't care, didn't seem like bothered by, the whole thing. Mom would come back and the kid again wouldn't really even look up from their toys to like care that mom was back, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of seem to have no reaction. Then you have the fourth one, which is your fearful avoidant or disorganized kid who would be, they were confused and they didn't have one specific way of handling the situation, but there was fear involved, fear of the stranger, fear that mom was leaving, but it was kind of like a mixed bag, but fear was like evident in the way the child was reacting. What is the most interesting part of this whole thing is that they took the kid's vitals, right? So you have the avoidant kid who seemingly doesn't care. You have the anxious kid who's like flying off the handle and having a tantrum. You have the secure kid, which, manages their like emotional state, and then the fearful avoidant kid. I think all of the kids except for the secure one had raised vitals. They were all equally nervous. They were all equally like worried and concerned that mom was leaving. Even the kid, the avoidant kid, that doesn't seem to care.
And these different styles, like how are they, what are they a result of? Is it like how the parents are behaving? Is it the relationship to the parent? Is it certain incidents that happened? Like how do people come into a certain category?
So there's some typical ways that kids are like, and what I've learned, the more I do this, the more I realize it's very much a spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people that are very much that distinction. Like I primarily am very much anxious. There's no question, no doubt, right? Like, so, but a lot of people are a mixed bag and there is a spectrum. So I think that's important to say. But typically for the avoidant kid, their emotions were neglected and avoided. Probably their parents were avoidant as well. So they didn't know how to deal with emotions. So when your emotions are not nurtured or supported or cared, you know, you don't get a lot of reaction to your emotion, right? Like maybe mm-hmm. I always point to the cry it out method as being one of the reasons that so many people in a certain age group are avoidant, because basically the method, and some doctor wrote a book and told moms to let their children cry it out and like not tend to them when they're crying in order to teach them to self-regulate, which is crazy, because how is a 3-month-old supposed to self-regulate? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. 3-month-old needs care, not to be ignored, right? So just from that time, it, you know, you're learning at 3 months old, at 2 months old, whatever age it is, that like you're crying and nobody cares. Nobody is coming to you. Nobody's helping you. Nobody is nurturing you, you know? And so you learn, even by 1.5, that there's no point to cry. There is no point to have emotions, because nobody is going to see them, notice them, or be, you know, give you any kind of reaction to them. So that's like the avoidant kid. Typically, that's how they, you know, they become avoidant. Also with avoidance, there's also this possibility of enmeshment, where there was too much overemphasis, they were just too much involved a little bit, like in an unhealthy way. And they want space, because it's like, they were never left alone. You know, they were always kind of somehow bothered, annoyed, depended on, or some version of that, right? But that's slightly, that's a side note a little bit. The main way is like the neglect, right, of emotions. For the anxious person, there was an inconsistency in the emotional attention. So they would be sometimes emotionally attuned to, is the official verbiage, emotional attunement. Sometimes they would get it, so they like really like enjoyed it, made them really happy. But then sometimes it would be pulled away. So let's say, like in my case, my parents were immigrants and they worked all the time. But when they were around, they were emotionally available to me, right? So mm-hmm. What happens is you become so because you're a kid, you don't know when that attention is coming back, if it's ever coming back. Like, you don't understand your mom's at work for 4 hours, right? You just think your mom's like left you. She's gone. Mm-hmm. She's coming back, you know? And every time you have to relive this feeling of abandonment, that this love, this attention that you get from the person you crave it from most is never going to come back. And you constantly have to like relive that feeling in your body as a child. And so by the time you're 1.5 years old and your mom's leaving, you freak out about it, because you're like, I don't know if she's ever going to come back, you know? And then you're upset with her that she made you feel that way. And that's why you hit her, you know? And then you have the fearful, avoidant person. Typically that comes from some real type of abuse or chaos in childhood, like something really, like something huge that happened. And so that child is afraid of the people that love them, basically. But I will say, typically the fearful, avoidant attachment style, it's like 5% of the population. Mm. So it tends to be smaller.
Yeah. So in my case, when let's say a mother, let's say, passes away, like, tragically, or let's say suddenly, mm-hmm. What does that do? Like, to what category do you then kind of move?
I mean, you would assume, just like if that's all I was told, I would assume probably fearful avoidant, but again, it's a spectrum and it can go any way, because kids are very, the thing that's also important to understand is kids are very nuanced. You can have two kids experiencing the same exact thing and they can both have different, you know, different reactions to it. So, you know, it depends. But I would say fearful avoidant would probably. And how old were you exactly?
1 year and 8 months.
1 year and 8 months. Yeah. Yeah. That would, I would definitely, there's like a, there has to be a huge abandonment, wound feeling, just like, you know, that lives inside of your nervous system, you know, that you, that's the thing that I think is most, I think if anybody wants to understand anything about attachment styles, like it took me a while to get to this realization, because there's a lot of characteristics that are involved. So it becomes interesting to be like, oh, well, you know, he avoids like emotional things, or she cries and screams all the time. But what is most important to understand about attachment styles is it's a nervous system reaction. Hmm. So it lives deep inside of your nervous system.
Yeah. And what does it mean? I hear nervous system more and more, also on Instagram. And self-regulation, but what does it mean that it's inside your nervous system?
It means it's something you have, like, you can't have control over until you realize what it is. It means that it's like, you know how something's falling, you know, something drops and your reaction is to grab it, right? That's mm-hmm. your first reaction. That's your nervous system reacting. Your brain isn't thinking, oh, look, something's falling. By the time your brain thinks it, it's already, your body's already in motion trying to catch the thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so your nervous system is what, it's like on automatic, right? So yeah. When a person is met with a trigger or like a, yeah, something that bothers them, something that triggers them, they have a certain way in which they react. And it's not conscious normally. It's not something you think about. It's just like your immediate reaction. Some people get anxious and some people shut down, right? The anxiety lives in your nervous system. The shutdown happens in your nervous system, and it's not something you consciously control until you become aware of it and learn to consciously control it.
So your response kind of already happens before you realize it, until maybe you become aware. And why is it that sometimes your one attachment in one situation and another attachment in the other situation? Because sometimes I consider myself avoidant, like not entering a situation. But sometimes I'm in a situation, I now use the word situation, I don't know if that's the right word, but I'm in a situation, or let's say connection. And then I become anxious or overthinking or overanalyzing what I've written. Mm-hmm. So is it possible to have different styles in different settings? And if the answer is yes, why is that?
So different people will call, different people that you're in relationship with will call on different parts of you, right? And also the circumstance itself and the depth of the circumstance will call on different parts of you. Now, if you're fearful avoidant, you will experience both the anxious attachment style and the avoidant attachment style at different times, right? But that, you know, that's part of the fearful avoidant attachment style. It's basically both. It's anxious and avoidant. In the beginning of a relationship, probably you're interested, you want to get really deep, you want to get very intense, and then once the person comes close to you because you fear love because it hurt you so much in childhood, you push away, you become avoidant, mm-hmm. you know, that's the fearful avoidant attachment style. That said, if somebody is severely, if you're secure and somebody is severely avoidant and you have a relationship with them, you will naturally become anxious because that person is so avoidant and they're pulling away. As a secure person, you're like, oh, but I love you. I care about you. I want to figure this out. I want to talk to you. I want to understand. And they're like, no, the more you want to understand, the more I pull away. And then, you know, the secure person's like, but what do you mean? This is like, we're just talking, you know, like, why is this so hard? And, you know, it would naturally cause the secure person to become anxious and vice versa. Like if you have a secure person, a highly anxious person, then the secure person will be like, all right, like we've talked enough, like I need some space right now, like it's good, you know. And you know, they might become more avoidant because the anxious person needs so much, wants so much, and like, you know, has to have their he has to get it all out. You know.
I see. So your attachment style can differ depending on the other person that you encounter. And if you look at the percentages of the population, you mentioned the fearful avoidant is more or less 5%. What percentages are the other categories, more or less?
They say, and I don't really believe these numbers because I don't know how they got them, but give or take 50% is secure, give or take avoidant and anxious are both around 23-ish, 20, 23, and then the fearful avoidant is 5%.
Interesting statistics. So could you say that typically speaking, the people that meet each other at a younger age and stay together are, let's say, more secure, and then people that are maybe single in their 30s and 40s belong to the other 50%, or is this lacking the nuance, this statement?
Yeah, I think that there's nothing, I don't think that there's a lot there. I think a lot of people that stay together, it's societal, cultural pressure. I think that most people that are married, you know, from their 20s, not all obviously, but I think we all aspire to these relationships of 40, 50, 60 years of people who did it in a healthy, happy, loving way. But I think most marriages that get into like 40, 50, 60 years, people aren't happy.
I see. So there's
forever meant to, I think when marriage was forever, we were dying at like 40 years old.
I see. So your point is beyond attachment styles, there's also other societal influences on these types of topics. So I'm curious, if we look a little bit at human history, in the 1950s and 60s, this attachment theory has been developed. And so this type of psychology is in a way still quite young or quite modern. And social media came, 10, 20 years ago. And you have a lot of followers on social media. I think 15,000 on Instagram and like 55,000 on TikTok. Why, a little bit from a societal perspective, why do you think these types of topics are now so popular?
Oh God, I love this question. So much to say. I think that, I really think dating apps have changed the culture of dating so much that people really, and the way that society has moved into like forcing us away from community, kind of forcing us into technology, forcing us into our phones, at least American society. I mean, I know that you're in Europe and you get around a lot more, but I think that we now have nothing but our computers and ourselves and our emotional like world and landscape. And like, that's kind of it. You know, you do have social interactions, not to say you don't, but it's so much less than it was before all of this technology. And now a lot of times you're having a relationship with an app or your phone. You know, you're not interacting face to face as much with people, where you have the opportunity to like work things out together. You almost like don't have that opportunity. You have to work things out internally. And then maybe you here and there, you get the opportunity to work things out, you know, with a partner or with a person. But I think it's forced us to really learn and understand our emotional landscape more. That's one. Two, women and men. We as women needed men to survive, right? We couldn't vote, we couldn't buy property, we couldn't, you know, pay taxes or, you know, we couldn't work at a time, right? And in the last 50 plus years, all of that has changed. And as women, we've always had just like a more naturally, we're more attuned to our emotions more naturally, right? It's just more accepted. It always has been. And now women can make their own money. Women don't need men to survive. Women, you know, can be perfectly happy and perfectly self-sustainable without a man. And we now, when we're looking towards men to be emotionally adept and emotionally available and emotionally attuned, well, they haven't learned those skills yet. And I think they are just now realizing that they need those skills in order to be with women. We're like now up here, we're graduating, you know, more women at this point graduate from college than men do. We're making our own money, you know, like all this stuff, and men just haven't caught up on the emotional scale yet. I think they're just realizing that they have to now, like from a societal bigger picture.
Yeah, I think that's it. So the digital developments I already understood, but these I never heard before. It's interesting because women have been their situation has been improved, you know, by a few things that you mentioned, like the right to vote, making more money than in the past, basically becoming more independent than in the past for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And now men realize that they need to step up their game. And before this podcast, I asked you to send a few videos. I always ask my guests to educate me a bit on topics. And one of the videos you sent is about Esther Perel, where she talks, I think, about this topic. Mm-hmm. That women are maybe more emotionally intelligent or educated, or that in society it's normal that they speak about emotions, but men are not trained like that. Can you elaborate more on the topic of the emotional intelligence of men and why there's a difference in that?
I mean, I think that if we're going to take it even from an attachment style perspective, I think that men are nurtured, raised, societally pressured to not have emotions, right? Men are supposed to be strong. Men are not supposed to cry. Men are supposed to be the stoic ones that like hold everything. And, I think it's a patriarchal issue, if you will, but I don't think it's men's today. It's a man's fault. It's just kind of how our society is developed, you know, and understandably given how we developed. That said, men typically do not have access to their emotions. And if you ask men, there's like so many different studies, right, that like men are lonelier than women. Men thrive in marriages and women do worse in marriages, both from a health perspective, a socioeconomic perspective. While men thrive, they're healthier, they're more successful. Men are now with women, like there's this whole big conversation about decentering men for women, right? Mm-hmm. So, which means like we don't really need them and we can do everything on our own. And if they're not going to bring something to our world that makes it better, we don't need the emotional mess that comes along with a man who's emotionally unavailable. Men are now realizing that they need to dig into their emotions, that their money is not enough, and that their, you know, their ability to fix something in the house is not enough. Or to carry heavy things is not enough, because we as women can now hire somebody to do
that. Opening the door, is that enough?
No. You know, it's a start, but it's not enough. Because ultimately there's only a certain level of depth that men have learned to go to. And this is also there's also studies about the loneliness of men. There's also studies about, there was a big thing on social media where men were talking about how they have less friends, right? Like in adulthood, they have less mm-hmm. male friends. And the male friends that they do have, I don't remember exactly where I heard this, but there's men have like side-by-side relationships, right? Meaning that they're watching something, like they're watching sports together, right? And they're commenting on the sports. They're doing sports together, right? Or playing golf together, but they're not emotionally connecting and communicating, right? Their relationships are more of a distraction oriented, you know? Whereas women face to face, and they can sit and talk for like 7 hours, you know, and get deep into their emotions. If you have two like female friends, right? It's not just about doing things. It's about like sitting and really getting deep with each other. And you don't find that with men a lot. Men don't really have that kind of connection with their friends. So they've just never learned. They've never learned to be emotionally connected, and they've never learned to go to those depths within their within themselves. And now's a great opportunity to do that, you know?
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point that you're talking about, because if I look, first of all, at my formal education, emotions was really never part of, let's say, formal education, because you have mathematics, geography, history. Then if I look at, let's say, my father, but it's not personally my father, it's also his generation, is also not so trained in emotions, right? It's more, especially after the Second World War, you know, like go to work, be productive, and try to make a living. For me, I discovered in my previous relationship in Amsterdam, I think that I was not so good in maybe detecting my emotions and communicating them, but I was already aware that I was not so good. And then a friend of mine, he started the Academy for Breathwork, Meditation, and Tantra. And then I went to one of his events, and then we started with breathwork, and then we had a few communication exercises and really communicate what's present and alive in you. And it fascinated me. First of all, the breathwork was really powerful, but also those exercises that I never did in another setting. And then I discovered this Tantra field and went to a bunch of retreats and courses and practiced, you know, what's alive in me right now, mm-hmm. Without wanting to know what that means in the future, what it means in the past, but more what's alive without needing it to have a result. So I think it was fascinating for me. So I'm still someone that is maybe more operating from the mind, but it really helped me a lot. And I feel I'm a better communicator with women, but also in business. In business, it also helps me when something is bothering me, I easier speak about it. But if someone is listening, let's say a man is listening to this, how do you start like building emotional intelligence? Like for me, it was this breathwork and tantra thing, but what are other ways that you can recommend if people want to work on this?
Come and work with me. I mean, you know,
that could be a good idea, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways, to your point. You know, some people access it through like breath work and meditation. I think meditation is a great, you know, starting point for anyone. But in order to have true depth with your emotions, or in order to truly understand your own emotions, there's got to be some, I think, like formal work, especially when you're starting from zero. So whether that's working with a therapist, or whether that's working with a coach, or breath work, I think breath work's supportive of it. But if you're not, if you have, a lot of times we have the experience in a moment, like let's say in a breath work session, and or even like doing ayahuasca or something like that, you know what I mean, having this like crazy opening of emotion, and then you go back to real life and you're not nurturing it and supporting it, you know, you're not like living into that experience more. So it's really important to have methods and tools to keep it open, to support that like openness and practice it. And a lot of times you need support to do that, you know, you need, whether it's with a therapist, whether it's through a relationship that you guys decide accountability wise, like, I want you to keep me accountable. I want to be more open. But there's so much to know and to learn about yourself that it, I think, like, again, you need the support of a therapist or a coach or something to help you guide you a little bit, you know, even if it's for a short time.
Yeah. So a therapist or a coach, or going to tantric, let's say, practice could benefit. So what I'm learning from this conversation is that men and women are obviously wired differently, and women have grown towards becoming more independent in history. And now men also realize that they need to step up their emotional intelligence game. And that's mm-hmm. why also these topics are more popular. So men and women meet and they have different fields, but also if people from different attachment styles meet, it's also interesting. So why is it that the avoidant and the anxious, they really attract each other? We spoke about it briefly, but there's mm-hmm. even YouTube videos from the School of Life about this, and it can maybe lead to interesting and fascinating life situations. But can you elaborate why they attract each other and then what happens and et cetera?
So I always say, like, whenever somebody talks about a toxic relationship, that it's like 99.9% probably an avoidant, an anxious avoidant relationship of some sort. And basically what happens is the anxious person is attracted, because we talked about how the anxious child, like, became anxious because of the inconsistency of the love that they received, right? Like, sometimes mm-hmm. they got it, sometimes they, you know, and then it was taken away. So the anxious person in their nervous system, what love means to them is inconsistency and the up mm-hmm. and down. What does the avoidant do? The avoidant, like, initially can get close when there's no emotional, you know, depth for them. They can get close, they can seem secure, but then they pull away, because at some point when the emotional heaviness of the relationships gets too much for them, they pull away, right? Mm-hmm. So that pull away for the anxious person, they're like, oh, this is love. You know, like, mm-hmm. I'm used to this kind of in, out, so this must be love, you know? And for the avoidant person, the anxious person is very attractive because they're not attuned to this part of themselves that is so emotional and that is so free with their, like, energy and open. And so the avoidant person tends to kind of fall for the anxious person because of how emotional they are, but then they also can't handle it. It's also too much for them, you know? And so they develop from childhood very different coping mechanisms, very different behaviors, very different understandings of what they need, very different needs in a relationship. The avoidant needs space. The anxious person needs closeness. The avoidant person self-soothes. The anxious person soothes through connection. The, you know, you can go on and on about the list of differences between these two, but the attraction they have for each other is, like, subconscious, and they're not really understanding what the attraction is about. And then they get into a relationship and it becomes this whole toxic mess. The avoidance pulling away, the anxious person is crying and screaming, like, why are you leaving? I love you so much. The avoidant person maybe comes back, but, you know, is always on edge because they're like, oh, you want too much for me, you need too much for me. And it's just like this on and on cycle of toxicity, because neither one can give each other what they need because they don't even understand why or how they need it, and they don't understand themselves enough, you know, either, typically.
So it keeps going, and then someone once told me it ain't over till it's over, because I've had experience in the past where I kind of still want to clarify something. Uh-huh. You know, you want to have this one more chat, and I sometimes have this chat, and then it's like still not clarified, then I want one more chat. And then until someone is pissed off with me, like, hey, why do you want another chat? Now I've kind of learned it a little bit sometimes, you know, to just let things be a bit, or no, take time for it.
Uh-huh.
But what's this desire to have this one more chat type of thing? Is that related to an attachment style, or is it just general human behavior?
Well, I think a lot of people look for closure, right? Because they think somebody else can give them closure or give them, I think, again, it leads back to this, it's like a control issue, right? Like if I could understand what went wrong the next time, I can not do that thing and then be more successful and get, you know, the desired result. But the reality is that, first of all, most of the time, people aren't going to tell you, what really was the issue, you know, and they may not even know themselves. There's just something that's not working for them and they don't know. It's so subconscious. It's so like not murky for them too, that they don't even know. So it's like you're searching for this like sense of closure from somebody that may not even be able to give it to you. And ultimately, I think it comes down, like I said, to a control issue, trying to, you know, have a better result next time.
Trying to learn from it and then trying to improve it. I was in Costa Rica. I spent 2 months in a community called Pachamama. And there was a spiritual leader. He's an Israeli man. And we had like a 1 week meditation retreat. And then twice a day, he had like 1 hour wisdom sessions. It was really cool. And then people could ask questions about life. And then he would answer. And I learned a lot from other people's questions, etc. So I asked one question that sometimes I feel lonely. And I asked that, like, how can I feel less lonely? Then he said, there's a difference between loneliness and aloneness. Because you're born alone, you die alone. So basically, you need to learn alone to just be alone instead of being lonely. But another thing he said is that never ask why it didn't work. Because it only gets worse and worse. Because if you keep asking, someone has to tell you something that is not necessarily helping you. So that was kind of an advice that stuck with me. But anyways, another question I have about, there's, let's say, reality. And then there's, let's say, fantasy. And I think many people are familiar with fantasy. Sometimes you meet someone, maybe you think about the future, or you think about next week, or you kind of fantasize. But some people are better maybe in staying in, let's say, the reality. But sometimes I have a bit these thinking in the future type of things. I also have it in business. And in business, it serves me because I can kind of show the future to people, and then they get really excited and motivated. And because it's also a bit how my mind works, I don't see it as a lie. It's not like, oh, I'm lying, I'm showing it to you. It's more like I kind of be optimistic because I can show kind of potential. Mm-hmm. I think in startup language, they also call it hockey sticks, where you see these financial projections going through the roof. But then sometimes in dating, these future projections, they don't necessarily serve me. So the question I have is, where do these come from? And to what extent are they related to your attachment theory? Because since that's a bit the topic of this podcast.
Well, typically the anxious person does a lot of future tripping is one of the things, you know, one way that that's termed. And, you know, the anxious person just immediately will meet someone and be like, oh, you know, this is my husband and, you know, I know for sure. And he's so amazing. And, you know, looking at everything with rose colored glasses and, you know, kind of imputing all of their hopes and dreams onto this person because there's this desperation to have the relationship that will fix their internal issues, you know, and that's how the fantasy thing comes up in the attachment styles. I think that it's normal, right? We also societally have all been pressured into this idea that, or have been conditioned with this idea that we're supposed to meet someone, you know, we're supposed to get married and live happily ever after, right? Disney, I think, ruined all of us. Men and women have their own fantasy about being the, you know, the knight in shining armor and the, you know, the princess up in the tower kind of thing. and so I think it's normal to have, you know, these fantasies, but it's when the fantasy takes over the reality that it becomes problematic. And when you can't see the reality, because the fantasy or the hope for that outcome becomes more important than what's actually happening, you know, in the relationship, in the moment, in the day to day.
I know it can kind of distract you from the present moment, and
allow it ends up allowing you to accept a lot of really bad behavior, right?
Because that's a shift I feel I'm currently in, that maybe in the past, I'm not talking about every single person that I'm meeting, but like when I'm interacting with someone, that I wanted that person to like me instead of kind of realistically assessing whether you're kind of a good match.
Right.
So I feel that's more the shift I'm in, to like more realistically feel into it, if it's a match, instead of like hoping that the other person likes me. Is that also something you've experienced in your life, like hoping the other likes you, or how has that been in your personal life?
I mean, as an anxious person, yes, yes, and yes, like a million times over, you know, it's hard to stay in the reality of what's happening. And it has caused me to end up in a lot of relationships where I wasn't really happy. But again, even my marriage, I think, like before I even knew anything about attachment styles, right, I knew that it felt like I had to get married. It felt like I had to have that like box checked off the list of things, you know, life things that needed mm-hmm. to be done. And I ended up in a marriage with somebody I didn't even like, you know, I mean, and I stayed with him, moreover, even as a modern woman that believes in divorce and, you know, always had her own job and, you know, whatever. I still couldn't, like, divorce seemed like such a mountain to climb that it seemed almost impossible and seemed like a failure, you know, because again, like conditioning wise through societally, we think of divorce as some sort of like failure, like it's bad, you know, it's not something you want to go through. And so I tortured myself, my ex-husband, and the whole family staying in something that I was so unhappy in that I couldn't even see how unhappy I was, for the sake of, you know, having this outcome, being married, having two kids and whatever.
That's an important point that you make, that there are certain maybe societal expectations or things that we think society expects of us, because society is also a big words. Sometimes it's not even true, but we think it. Uh-huh. So in your program, because I also want to talk about a bit about your program and maybe also what I've experienced there, but what do you do in your program or in your approach to help people get more awareness of, let's say, what's kind of this societal conditioning and what's maybe their true desire?
I mean, you know, I think that's a lot of it is what I help people to parse that out, to figure out what is it that I've been conditioned with? What are these behaviors that came from how I needed to be in childhood in order to receive acceptance, in order to receive love, and recognize those behaviors, recognize those coping mechanisms, recognize that part of your nervous system that is in reaction to, and then decide, do I still need this? Like, is this, you know, or if I need it, when do I need it? You know, when do I need to like hold on to this part of me? And if not, you know, we work on releasing it and building new habits towards that feel more healthy and more aligned with what you need now. Because we don't have awareness, but we almost don't have control over what's happening when we're being raised. You know, you're too young. You're being molded and you have no idea. But when you grow the awareness, or when you get the awareness of these certain coping mechanisms, and you realize they're not healthy and they're not working for me anymore. And it usually happens through some sort of life tragedy, right? Like for me, I got divorced. And I had to like face myself in a new way that I never had to face myself before. Sometimes there's a breakup, sometimes somebody dies, sometimes, you know, who knows, like somebody loses a job and, you know, then their whole identity is lost and they have to, face themselves in a new way. And so, in fact, I lost my job, I lost my father, and I got divorced all within like a 2-year span. So everything I thought I was, all the identity points, you know, that I had of myself were like gone, you know? And so it often happens like that, where you adopt the work, then you start to like really get deeper and start to want to understand yourself. And so, you know, I like to think that I help people get to know themselves better so that they can be a person that they like and then exude that into the world. And then, you know, love naturally happens. You don't have to try anymore.
And I recognize that you can lose a few things at the same time. I also had it like 10 years ago, a relationship finished, a job finished. And maybe I also changed house, but sometimes in life everything comes together, but these are kind of these awakening moments. If you look at your program, I want to talk about it a little bit. How have you structured it, and why have you structured it like this? Because it's quite a big theme, dating, love, attachment styles, and of course I've experienced it, but can you share a bit more in your own words, like, yeah, the structure and why you've chosen it like that?
Well, basically, you know, we start with like the societal conditioning piece of things, because it's like been, you know, very important to recognize what desires, thoughts are yours versus what society has told you you're supposed to want. For example, you know, being married to one partner for the next 50, 60 years, like, is that what you really want right now, or is that what you were told you're supposed to want and supposed to have, you know, like having a traditional job, a 9-to-5, and you work your way up corporately, and all the structures are breaking down right now anyway, but you know, a lot of people, like, you have to go to college and then you know, work in the corporate world, and then you live and die at the same company for 25 years. Like, is that what you want, or is that what you were told was the right way to go, you know? So it's really important to first see what's yours and what's, you know, was forced upon you, kind of. And then we work inwardly with kind of understanding how your personality was formed within your childhood, resolving those patterns, and then we create a vision for the future.
That's a nice summary. So you look at societal conditioning, you look at your childhood and vision for the future. And one of the things that I got out of your program is a bit maybe a limiting belief that subconsciously something I feel when I'm in intimate relationship, that kind of my life finishes, or my life has ended, and that suddenly I can't travel anymore, or I'm stuck in one place. But at this moment I would like to be maybe 6 months per year in Portugal, but also maybe 6 months somewhere else, or more or less. So I realized that there's of course also other people that like this lifestyle, so I can be more intentional about it. But that was kind of a limiting belief I had. And I also became more aware of, like, when is it the fantasy and when is it the reality? Whenever I might catch myself in the fantasy at the moment, I try to kind of get myself back into the present moment. And it was nice to kind of bring awareness to this topic specifically, because maybe in the past with a coach or a therapist, maybe the topic crossed, you know, we talked about it, but not like specifically. Similar, like last Thursday, I hosted a vision dinner. When you think about a vision, it's like, oh, I have a vision. But then I found out a quiz. It's called the visionary quiz. And then you fill out a bunch of questions, and then you'll see there's 5 types of visionaries. Then you see what type of visionary you are, your gifts, your challenges. So I think there's a certain beauty. Whenever you focus on one topic, you suddenly realize how little you know. So that has been a bit my experience. How do you... what are your recommendations for balancing action versus non-action? Like, let's say you built a business. Some of the stuff you have to do is, let's say, at being level, at mindset level. It's like believing in yourself and like growing certain beliefs to grow. And certain things are action, you know, make a website, talk to clients, etc. It's a lot of action, but also sometimes non-action. Like I think next week you're going on a holiday, right? It's non-action, but it might serve your business. But then in dating, I mean, you can download dating apps, you can, but you can also, you know, just wait and see. So what are your thoughts on action versus non-action within the field of dating?
Well, I think it's so dependent on each person, right? You know, I like to say, and I think it's true, I don't give advice, right? Because it's pointless, because we're all different, and giving advice is too general, right? Any kind of advice. Text, don't text, you know, for an avoidant person, it's going to be yes text. For an anxious person, it's going to be don't text, you know, mm-hmm. like it's going to be very different. So it's hard to give advice. And the same applies to action and non-action. There's a time to go inward for sure and learn about yourself. And I think that is imperative for everyone, right? Secure, anxious, avoidant, fearful, avoidant, everyone needs to go inward and learn about themselves, understand their coping mechanisms, understand their needs, understand their behaviors. And then action is relational, right? And what a lot of people do in spiritual growth recognize is that you're going inward, you're spending a lot of time like in your own head, figuring things out, changing your mindset, talking to yourself in a different way, all this stuff. But you don't really know how much you've grown until you've gotten out into the world and other people are reflecting to you, right? Mm. And are you getting triggered still? Are you not getting triggered anymore? Are you, you know, experiencing new things, or is it the same old stuff that keeps coming up? You know, are you experiencing the same old stuff in a new way? Is there like a new perspective? Is there a new reaction? So without the feedback, you have no way of knowing how much you've grown. So it's important to have a balance of inner work, but mindful action, you know, mindful relational experience. So that you can constantly reflect and change what needs to be changed, if anything.
Yeah, I see. So it's a combination of inner work and mindful relational action, because it's in the relationships. Yeah. You learn, and a relationship doesn't need to be a formal relationship, but can also be an interaction, having a lunch with someone, talking to someone. Exactly. So that's a bit of a balancing act. And go ahead.
I was going to say, if you want to just be more practical about it, you know, like I would say that if you're dating and you're hitting a wall and, you know, you're miserable, and it's not, you feel like nothing is working, stop dating. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This is not a good attitude to be doing anything with, right?
Yeah.
It's a time to go inward and take a break. You know, the universe is telling you that this is not the time. Like, you need to go like figure something out, you know? If you're having a great time and everything's working out and you're just enjoying yourself and whatever, building relationships, then great, keep going at it. But, you know, I think just in general, like if you're hitting a wall at anything, it's a time to stop and go inward, you know?
Yeah. I think that's good advice. And I think I told you a bit about some of my addictions, but one of my addiction has been the Mindvalley platform. Like when I left Amsterdam and I started traveling, I spent like 1 year, a lot of time on Mindvalley, looking at their videos and their courses. And one of the teachers is Catherine Woodward Thomas. She's a world-renowned therapist, coach in the field of love. I think she wrote a best-selling book, Calling in the One. And I watched a video of her, and one of the questions she asked is like, what's the one thing that you want to change about yourself before showing up to someone else? And when she asked that question, I realized it was quitting alcohol. Mm-hmm. That was kind of something that I changed. But how do you look at this type of question or philosophy? Like, what's this one thing you want to change about yourself in this process? And I'm not asking you what you want to change, but how do you look at this question?
I think it's a very important question, because part of what I do also is, you know, we look at what you want, right, in a partner. We look at the depth of it, not just these filters that we all put in. Oh, I want him to be 6 feet tall, and I want him to, you know, be rich, and I want him to be successful, and, you know, not like superficially, but like really the depth and the feeling of what you're looking for in a relationship. And then, you know, the next question is, how do you give that to yourself? Are you that yourself also? You know, can you give the things that you're looking for? So I think it's really important to recognize that you can't call in. I mean, it's not that you can, it's never happened, but like you call in what you believe about yourself. And that's why the relational aspect, the mindful relational aspect of things is so important, you know, because for example, there was a time when I was calling in a lot of people that weren't like getting back to me, or were avoidant, or were, you know, like I'd be waiting for a phone call and I wouldn't get the phone call back, or I'd be waiting for a text and they're not responding. And at that time, I would make it mean something about me. Oh, here we go again. Oh, you see, I'm not lovable. Oh, this just proves there's something wrong with me and I need fixing and all of this stuff. And now when somebody gets back to me, I'm like, oh, okay, good note. This is not the type of person I'm interested in. Moving on, you know? It's no longer, because I've resolved those issues that were about me, I no longer take that reflection to mean something about me. Yeah. And I know that I've like moved past that place. So, you know, that was the work, some of the work that, you know, I had to do, and what the result of it is, you know?
Yeah. I think it makes complete sense. So instead of taking it personal, you're just realizing it's not the best match, and then you can move on. Also, out of the 8 billion people, I mean, you can't get along with everyone, right? That's also a good realization. And if you look at some spiritual teachings, sometimes I like to watch some YouTube videos, and someone I discovered recently is Abraham Hicks. Uh-huh. And I like some of the things she says. And one of the things is, in your life, you can go upstream or downstream. Uh-huh. So upstream is like a bit of a struggling. Uh-huh. or resistance or trying a lot, trying too much. And then downstream is kind of when you're in the flow. Uh-huh. And for instance, at this moment in my life, I really feel life is going downstream. Uh-huh. Also where I live, with my exercise, spending a lot of time in nature, also Soul Kitchen, like how we got to know each other, you know, things are kind of in flow. And then I realized I had one job like many years ago, 10 years ago. And then looking back, it felt really like going upstream. It was a struggle. Sometimes also in dating, I already knew it didn't work, but then I was like going upstream, you know, like denying that it didn't work or trying to make it work. A lot of like, let's say, the trying. Mm-hmm. But in maybe your own life or in your clients, like this upstream, downstream, like theory, like does it resonate a bit in relation to dating? And can you share a few things about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think there's a lot of holding on and a lot of forcing and control. You know, there's a lot that has to do with control, right? There's a lot of controlling, there's a lot of forcing, and there's a lot of trying to, again, get an outcome. And anytime mm-hmm. you're trying to get an outcome, you're trying to control how, when, where, who, you know. And ultimately, I've come to this place just in life, spiritually, and in, you know, in reality, that you're just not going to control things. You know, you can manage how you react and how you respond rather than react to what is happening, but you can't control an outcome. You know, you can control your best efforts towards an outcome. You can control like how you go through the process of trying to achieve an outcome, but you can't control that where, when, how the outcome is going to happen, and if it's going to happen. You know, you can only control your your perception and your reactions to it. And so, you know, it's the same in dating. It's the, you know, people get attached to this idea, no, I have to be married to this one guy and or this one girl, and this is, you know, my soulmate, and this is these words. Don't get me started on that whole conversation. Soulmate, twin flame. You know, it just like it fuels the fire for all of these negative attachments to people, to relationships and stuff. And so I guess, like, at the end of the day, like, the Buddhists were right, you know, detachment.
Like, yeah. So instead of attachment, detachment, and letting go of control.
There's
a bunch of people, when I interview them on my podcast, they keep referring to Buddhist wisdom. So I think at some point I want to spend some time in a Buddhist center. But no, thank you for sharing that. So I shared Abraham Hicks. And if you look at, let's say, role models, I mean, you are inspiring more than 50,000 people online because they are following you. But who are the people that inspire you? So who are your teachers or role models online? I always find it fascinating to understand how my podcast guests get inspired.
Well, Esther Perel is like huge. She's huge in the dating field, and she's just a huge inspiration. Also, because as much as I talk about attachment styles, she very rarely speaks of it in that way. She alludes to the concepts, but she just has like such a different lens, and it's so in depth. I love, love, love her. Mark Groves, I don't listen to him as much these days, but he has, his thing is called Create the Love. I think that's his Instagram, Create the Love. And he was extremely, extremely like life-changing at the time when I was growing into this version of myself. He's very inspiring and also is really well-spoken on this, on all relational topics. He's a relational coach, I think he calls himself. I don't even know her name, but on Instagram, she's We After Me, I think. And she just like, she's also a therapist. Everything she says, like, I feel like I wrote it or said it, or I agree with literally every single post that she has. And I'm always, you know, I always love the, how she comes at it. And then I've always listened to this You Up podcast. Betches Media with Jared Fried, and it's more fun. It's more just like dating stuff happening, you know, the regular kinds of, oh, I met a guy, I don't know, he didn't call me back, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's a guy and a girl, and I just love their, you know, back and forth. And the guy had his own dating podcast also for a long time, has his own dating podcast as well. So I love hearing from that lens, you know, from the other side, because it always gives you a man's perspective, right?
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing inspiration. I think that's good to have sources for men and women. And if you look at your own future vision, because part of your program is helping people with their future vision, but if you look at your future vision as a, let's say, entrepreneur slash coach slash maybe online teacher, what's your aspiration for where you want to be in a few years from now?
Oh, geez, I'm still figuring it out. you know, I definitely, I mean, you know this from the retreat, the vision retreat that I went on, which really was really impactful. I can't say enough. And I love that I was on the first one. Because it's grown so much, you know, I can't say enough, like, how impressive it's been to watch this growth. And it's only since last year, it hasn't even been a whole year yet. So it's been a beautiful inspiration to watch. And, you know, definitely, I want community, I want, you know, more in real life interaction with people, you know, and I want to start to grow that side of my business more, which I haven't really even stepped into properly. But that's kind of, you know, my real hope for the future, because I know how much I think we all need community and connection more than anything right now, especially kind of like, you know, on the opposite side of COVID, right, where we were all kind of forced in and stuck in. I think a lot of us are still on that hamster wheel, you know, where it's like we don't know how to really properly get out of it.
I see. So you're still also figuring out your vision along the way. Yeah. Do you see yourself also speaking on stages on physical events, or are you more an online person, or both?
I don't know. I have stage fright, so. but yeah, no, I would love to do that. I definitely want to. I've started a book. The book that I thought of in one of our breathwork sessions. So. Cool. At the Vision Retreat, which is all kind of related to what I do, and I'm excited about that. And I would love to definitely like speak on stages and be out there more than I currently am. But I think for me, there's always more learning and always more development and always more kind of pushing myself into discomfort, you know, as I teach my clients to do in the realm of love and dating and communication.
Yeah, no, I see. It's a step by step. You're growing into a new version of yourself. And one of your USPs, so to say, from a business point of view, is your social media presence. So if someone is listening and they want some advice on that, like what's your one piece of advice to, let's say, grow an audience on TikTok and Instagram?
Be authentic and tell real stories, you know? That's what I would say is, you know, talk about your life, I was just on a call this morning with like another coaching group that I'm a part of. And one of the guys was saying that, you know, he's got all these edited videos that he writes a script for, and, you know, he has an editor doing them. And he's like, my most successful videos are the ones where I'm just talking about mine and my wife's relationship and, you know, how we function together. And I don't even edit, you know, I don't send them to the editor. I just kind of put them out there. And he's like, those are my most successful videos, you know? And I think these days people really are looking to relate and looking for realness and looking for authenticity. So throw the script out and talk about something you're struggling with or something you got over, you know?
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. I also spoke with Adriaan Kool from Personal Branding. He said exactly the same. So people want personal stories instead of hearing what Harvard has to say about dating or Stanford.
Right. You can throw that in, but you know, you do have to offer that personal touch. Nobody wants, you know, the days of the influencer are over, you know.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, look, everything looks perfect, you know, nobody's interested in that anymore. People want like some real life stuff that they can relate to.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. So the entire concept of the Soul Kitchen is that people can find recipes for life, that every guest shares kind of their recipe. So I'm curious, based on a few decades that have you been walking around this planet, what is kind of your recipe for life that you can share with the listener?
Oh, God. Definitely learn yourself, you know, learn your triggers, your coping mechanisms, your needs. Understand yourself first. That's number one. And then, you know, and then be you. Be the version of you that you imagine that you are, like actually be that, physically be that, you know, and know that most people are so deeply in their own head that they're not thinking about you nearly as much as you think they are. In fact, they're only about what you think of them. So, you know, the more like open and authentic and loving and kind that you can be, the more that allows other people to be that, to reflect that back to you.
Yeah, I see. So don't assume that people are thinking about you, but they might be thinking about what you think of them.
Yeah,
that's a funny one. Well, thank you for sharing this recipe and all your wisdom. Before we close the episode, and before you maybe go to your next client, because I know you're always busy, which is a good sign. Like, is there anything else you want to share with the listener?
Obviously, like, I'd love for you to follow me, or if you're interested in doing this work and kind of really understanding yourself better and getting a map of your personality and deciding, you know, the things you want to keep and the things you want to grow into, please reach out to me either on Instagram at redo.love or on TikTok at redo_love.
Well, thank you. Highly recommended to follow Flora. And thank you for listening. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thank you for your time, Flora, and your week.
Thank you so much.